About 2 weeks ago, Grumpy Cat died, and we got an email. If you do not know who Grumpy Cat is, don't worry. There's nothing wrong with you that can't be cured with more time online. Seriously, Grumpy Cat was a cat. A real cat from Arizona named Tartar Sauce with a grumpy face. And the face was funny, and the internet got a hold of her and turned her into a meme. And a meme is... that comes later. Anyway, 2 weeks ago, Grumpy Cat, at age 7, passed away. Claire, tell me about the email we got.
So we get an email from Amber LeBlanc, who's the news director at 680 News in Toronto, forwarding us a list of experts recommended from the University of Toronto. So in this email of experts, we have, you know, Canada and U.S. close to steel and aluminum tariff deal, and the expert on that. We have an expert talking about the Toronto Raptors, and then we have an expert for Grumpy Cat.
Viral sensation Grumpy Cat has died. You might want to talk to...
Ian Dennis Miller, PhD student in the Department of Psychology. So his expertise, social psychology, social influence of memes. He started his research in 2011 with cat memes. So we get this email from Amber. She says, just flagging this, U of T expert who studies cat memes, and she'll send us stuff kind of when she finds something that she thinks is relevant to our show. And I don't know, I saw this email and I thought it was kind of she was sending it as a joke.
She was not sending it as a joke. The news director of 680 News does not send us breaking news alert emails as a joke. She thought this was a serious subject, and you know what? So do I. Okay, that might be a lie. But I did know that as soon as there was a day when the world wasn't ending and that we needed a weird story for a nice spring weekend, that we would call up Ian Dennis Miller and ask him to explain. To explain Grumpy Cat, and to explain memes, and to explain why this all matters, and how exactly you create a PhD thesis around it. So that's what we did. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Ian Dennis Miller needs no more introduction at this point. Hi, Ian.
Morning.
First of all, can you define a meme for us? What is a meme?
Sure. That's where all this has to start. So Richard Dawkins in the 1970s wrote a book called The Selfish Gene. And it was about a genetic story of genes competing with one another. And he just included a chapter about culture. And he coined a term, meme, didn't really exist before that point. He drew inspiration from some linguistic roots about imitation and copying. And that relates to his ideas of the selfish gene. And the word took off. It sort of framed memes as almost like a living creature, as an entity unto itself that was engaged in this survival of the fittest sort of mechanism, exactly or analogous to what he was saying about genes. And that was both good and bad for understanding what memes actually are, because in so many ways he didn't actually invent the idea. There's a lot of precedent for the idea. There's a whole field of semiotics, the study of signs and what they signify. That stretches back to at least the 1800s. And it's also the case that by characterizing this as almost a living creature, in some ways, it draws a separation between or a separation from the media itself, the content, and the people who are interacting with the content and the people who are going to be responsible for sharing the content. So some people have taken the idea of memes, in particular Susan Blackmore, is kind of a radical memeticist who's elevated the meme to the level at which it is a parasite, a mental parasite that practically lives inside our brains and uses us as a host. As the ideas are passed from one individual to another, and she argues that memes shape us to be better hosts of memes. And Dawkins himself has backed off from that idea a little bit. But the notion of a piece of content that represents something that a lot of people can relate to, that goes back way farther than Richard Dawkins. He just coined a great term that people really loved to talk about. And so in some ways, the meme is itself the first meme. In some ways, by coining the term, Dawkins just, he made the first meme. And the first meme was the meme.
What you just described very academically sounds really removed from what pops up in the head of the average person when speaking to a friend or colleague who says, hey, have you seen this meme? How did what began in the 1970s and clearly has been talked about in academic circles since then as something that eats its way into our brain and is representative of our shared culture and all of that become what it is today online? Because that's where we all assume it is.
Yeah, how did the meme turn into the kind of post-2000s idea of what the meme is? I think one of the key changes was social media. The meme was always social. It always had something to do with a shared understanding. But the technology to bring people together and facilitate sharing exploded in the post-internet world.
I'm going to stop you right there then and give me an example of a meme from the 1990s before this exploded.
Any advertisement that has a jingle, if you've heard the term earworm, something that it gets into your head and you kind of repeat this yep. Melody, that's a perfect meme. But people point to, Dawkins points to architectural ideas like the arch itself being an idea for building structures that have this integrity, and the idea itself spread from civilization to civilization. It had all the characteristics of a modern meme, but it came from antiquity.
And it was also useful.
And it was useful.
As opposed to today's memes?
Well, I would argue that there's a reason memes are successful, and it does, at some level, relate to an aspect of the utility that it provides us. So, for example, funny memes, it feels good to laugh at stuff.
So everything explodes in the 2000s when social media arrives. What changes about memes then?
Well, to the extent that memes are mediated, to the extent that a meme is, it has an external component outside of your brain. It has to be written down. It has to be represented somehow in a form that can be copied, that can potentially be mutated. To the extent that there's a really strong dependency upon the medium, social media became rich enough by the 2000s that it could really sustain some interesting cultural engagement. The internet prior to the 2000s wasn't especially visual. There were little quirks like the blink HTML tag that made these kind of prototypical right. 1990s websites that were just, they were hideous to look at. Mm-hmm. And the capacity for us to use that medium to really express what was inside of us, it really facilitated our ability to take something inside of ourselves and put it out there in a way that actually was really meaningful, deeply meaningful to other people.
Well, as I mentioned in the intro, we're talking to you today because U of T sent out an email last week when Grumpy Cat died, offering up you as an expert on this topic. What did Grumpy Cat mean to us?
I think Grumpy Cat is a level of maybe, say, it's a collective sophistication. The early memes were typically funny. They, as I said, they made us feel good. We wanted to share them because this positive emotion, we felt it. And maybe we wanted other people to feel the same thing. Grumpy Cat was a little different. Grumpy Cat, yeah, there's a funny dimension to it. But Grumpy Cat's a vehicle for expressing more than just, I feel good. Mm-hmm. Grumpy Cat's a way of expressing and exploring these other aspects of the common human experience, which is not just happy. You know, it's not just this delirious, everything is great. Grumpy Cat gives us a vehicle for talking about the things that we're sarcastic about or, you know, cynical or simply pessimistic about. Grumpy Cat is a way for us to project these other aspects of the human experience and share those.
There's Grumpy Cat the meme, obviously, which will, I'm sure, be GIF'd and posted for another decade or two. And then there's, you know, the actual cat. And what fascinated me so much about the attention that this cat's passing got was the connection that we all drew from the meme that we had shared to the living creature that is no more. And how did we form an attachment to an animal I'd never seen outside of some GIF on Twitter?
I think we developed an attachment to Grumpy Cat long before Grumpy Cat was ever born. Grumpy Cat is a real creature. May he rest in peace. But Grumpy Cat is also a cat, and cats have been around for a long time. Cats have been domesticated for millennia, perhaps 9,000 years. They represent something a lot more than what Grumpy Cat is. Cats can also represent hunting and stealth, a sense of cunning. There's a relationship between a cat and a mouse. And when you attribute significance to the cat, and when you worship that, and when you incorporate that into your culture, a culture that also includes warfare and blood and sacrifice, the cat comes to represent so much more than just the cat.
So cat is a meme, never mind Grumpy Cat.
Absolutely.
This is insane.
I think it's one of the best ways I could spend my time studying anything.
It's fascinating.
It opens up the whole world. Absolutely.
So I'm going to quote to you from a sentence from your own bio on your website, and then you're going to explain it to me in non-academic language. His research uses memes to gain insight into the propagation of ideas across networks and the outcomes thereof. Give me an example of doing that and what the outcome was.
Well, we've certainly talked about jingles and advertising. I think we've seen more recently the ways that networks can be formed to share ideas that can be politically useful. I think there's a brand new opening in sort of the frontier of memes that has to do with propaganda and misinformation. Mm-hmm. These are not new ideas, but by having a new unit of analysis, like for better and for worse, this idea of the meme kind of gives us a little box to put ideas into and start trying to do science, start trying to do research with these units of culture. And it opens up methods for gaining insight into these really fascinating processes that, like with humor, misinformation spreads through networks in ways that have real-world consequences. And I've got to say that's fascinating, but it's also a little bit scary in some ways.
Yeah.
So memes are a really new tool, and I think we can really push this idea a lot farther to understand what's happening right now, politically, culturally, but happening globally as well.
How do you do that research? What do you quantify? What do you measure and record?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because I think it's still unanswered. It's part of what I'm actually trying to articulate through my research. And I have moved into the world of computational simulation, trying to take the essence of what memes are and what culture is and develop computer mirrors, simulacrum, that represents as closely as possible the real world but permits us to examine hypotheticals that maybe don't exist in the real world. And when it's a computer simulation, you can run it a lot faster than real life. So, for example, I do study memes on Twitter. I log as much data as I can, but there are all these practical issues related to privacy and related to the economics of this and related to the limits that Twitter places on your ability to capture raw memes in the wild. So by taking this into a virtual simulated universe, my hope is that it's possible to do the same kinds of research in what I like to think of as almost parallel universes and do it fast.
You would like test the memeability of something and see how far it spreads?
Absolutely.
Like a picture of one cat versus another cat and see. I'm using cats because we're talking about Grumpy Cat, but like two political statements done different ways and see which one has the wider reach in the wild?
Yeah, absolutely. There's current research that people do looking at stories that are funny, that are disgusting, that have these different characteristics that evoke outrage. There's a whole field of social transmission that looks at people and observes these relationships. And yeah, maybe it's a story that only differs in terms of its ability to evoke outrage. And the one story travels farther than the other. And so, yeah, I try to take those characteristics and model that as best I can.
So some memes are kind of exist purely on the internet as creations of whomever made them at home. But something like Grumpy Cat, which was an actual being, is one example. And that cat had to live the rest of its life after it became famous. I remember it was on TV shows and it did a little tour and stuff. There was a book. But there are also thousands of people by now who have become memes. What happens to those people? What does that do to them?
So I've seen a bunch of instances of this by now, cases where people become memes unto themselves. And again, it's not especially new. The notion of a celebrity, the notion of a star, right, the notion of somebody transitioning into this celestial, ethereal realm where they are remembered as something that they represent, not what they are. Again, this has been with us since the beginning of culture, essentially. I think one thing that is new is, well, I mean, again, this idea by now is 50 years old, but Andy Warhol famously quipped about the 15 minutes of fame.
Right. Now, I was just going to say, you're minute. It's not even that. It's like 10 seconds now.
That's right.
You're the guy that flipped over the banister and landed on his feet.
Exactly.
That's the first line of your obituary.
15 seconds of fame. Yeah, absolutely. These little stories. And there's a real sense in which the universe is made up of stories. And so we become part of this. We build the culture. We author the culture. We are ourselves.
Is there anything that I should be or our listeners should be aware of that memes are doing to us when we consume them online? Do we know anything about how they've changed us as they've become just so prolific everywhere?
This, I think, is a really deep question. So how are we changed by memes? One of the cynical investigations of this idea goes back to the 60s. A really fascinating line of reasoning coming from the Situationists, the thesis of which is the society of the spectacle, which criticizes what happens with culture as we move away from authentic experience and begin mediating our relationship with reality through the pictures and the representations that we come to associate with reality. And the cynical idea is that we eventually become divorced from reality. And the spectacle is the interaction only with the media and not with people, not with actual life.
Oh, God, that sounds frighteningly familiar.
Well, it really resonates, but I think it's too cynical to actually capture the full experience. But certainly there are aspects of this with, you know, Instagram influencers, for example, going around creating the representation of living these lavish lives that maybe they don't actually live. But as far as the images that they create are concerned, they might as well be living right that way. So there's a risk. There's a tendency to gravitate towards these representations. They are easy to consume. They're easy to produce. But each meme has an author. So fundamentally, the reason that I don't take this spectacular criticism as the complete story is because each meme does have an author. The authors have the ultimate decision-making power, the ultimate agency in all of this. And in terms of what we need to be vigilant for, in practical terms of what we need to be watching out for when it comes to meme culture, I look to political leaders as having a special responsibility to be the authors of these ideas, to create these visions that in liberal democracies take a life of their own in the ideas of the people who are ultimately going to grant consent in this political sort of democratic amalgamation right process. And it really changes everything. It changes reality altogether. So the people who are telling our stories, who are giving us dreams, are absolutely shaping the actual ways that dollars are spent, the roads that get built, the wars that are fought.
This is the, like, ask not what your country can do for you. That's a meme, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Those words were, they resonated with people.
Right.
And it did, it conveyed a message of hope and of agency, of self-determination. It was meaningful.
Some of those quotes, like that one or other ones from political leaders, Gorbachev, tear down this wall, that kind of stuff that still endures decades later, are memes. What memes from our current era, where memes have become this language we speak on the internet, will endure? Are we going to look back 30 years from now and view Grumpy Cat as one of the all-time memes of this era? Like, can you define those?
So when trying to predict what's going to be lasting, what memes are going to have staying power, I look less to the memes and I look more to the people. The way that I think about memes is in terms of what they represent to the largest number of people. That in some ways is what conveys the fitness to the meme, to get back to the Dawkins or even the Darwinian sense of the survival of the fittest. The ideas that speak to the most people are the ones that are going to be lasting. So to make predictions about what memes are going to be around 30 years from now, I think we need to look to what people care about now. I don't think people care about Grumpy Cat as a special cat necessarily, but people care about cats. And so there will absolutely be cat memes 30 years from now, as long as we care about cats. The kinds of issues that are in the news today, I think look to the headlines, look to the yearly summaries of...
It's going to be that guy sitting in a room surrounded by fire, sipping a coffee, saying, this is fine, right? That's the defining meme of our time.
That certainly speaks to me. I know exactly what that room on fire looks like. I know exactly. Here I sit sipping coffee right now. It resonates with me because it does seem like things are in disarray right now. There's a lot of chaos. And so
speaks to climate change too, which is something
absolutely.
We talk about all the time, right? It's capturing the mood of the populace.
That's right. So there was an idea of the zeitgeist that literally translates as the ghost of time, or the spirit of the time. And again, that the idea was around long before Dawkins coined the idea of the meme. But people already had a sense that whatever it was that everybody cared about, whatever that could be ephemeralized and expressed as, that's what mattered.
Finally, is it good or bad that I can have entire text conversations with friends of mine in only GIFs without a single typed word?
I believe the technology is agnostic. It is what we do with it. I would point towards the ancient Egyptians who essentially communicated entirely with emoticons. They got the whole thing done without anything that we would recognize as written language. It just looks like pictures. And, you know, one of the problems with that is that it's hard to understand exactly what they're talking about. It does, in a lot of ways, interfere with the ease with which we communicate. So I do think there's a timelessness to the written word. There's an additional ability to communicate when you commit something to a language that is widely shared and is not necessarily going to be easily dated to a decade or to a century. And I think our reliance on animated GIFs is going to be, will immediately place the speech in a certain time. So in that sense, you know, it's not great. But in another sense, it is absolutely the way to capture what is happening right now. The fact that we can do it, the fact that there's something that you want to express and you're able to manifest that through a sequence of animated GIFs, and the fact that other people are able to understand what you're saying, that means it's successful communication. And so in that sense, it works. So you can't argue with that.
Thanks, Ian.
My pleasure.
R.I.P. Grumpy Cat. Ian Dennis Miller, PhD candidate at the University of Toronto, perhaps the coolest PhD candidate on campus. Claire thought that email was a joke. Joining us quickly now is Amber LeBlanc, news director at 680 News. Hi, Amber.
Hey, Jordan.
Amber, turn over that paper. This is the email you sent us a couple weeks ago.
Okay. Yes, I did. This is not a joke. This is not a joke.
So read what it says.
It says...
Just the one line you wrote...
Just flagging this, and then caps, the U of T expert who studies cat memes. I mean, I chortled at first, but then I looked and, you know, it's a legit email. It's a legit subject matter that this person studies.
Do you think we should cover this subject?
Yes, I do.
Because we just did.
Oh my God, I can't wait to hear it.
That was the big story. For more from us, including probably zero stories even remotely similar to that one, you can find us at thebigstorypodcast.ca or on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. And of course, we are wherever you get podcasts, on Apple, on Google, on Stitcher, on Spotify. Claire Brassard is the lead producer of The Big Story.
Ryan Clark is our associate producer. So is Stephanie Phillips, while Annalisa Nielsen is our digital editor. And I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the weekend.